Welcome to Casa de Cambio podcast. We are back with season 8. I cannot believe it's been 8 seasons, and I am really excited to be joined this episode by Rebecca Motta. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here. This is my very first ever podcast.
Well, hopefully it's going to be a good experience for you. I'm so thrilled because I know we talked about, I floated the idea a long time ago, and you're finally here. We're finally doing it. How has your week been?
My week has been interesting. I'm American, as you can tell by my accent, and it's Halloween week. So I'm a little bit tired because we went trick-or-treating and all of that, but it's been a good week.
Did you were a lot of people trick-or-treating in your neighborhood?
Yes. Because we like to trick-or-treat ourselves, we have this pumpkin that we stuff our lollipops into, and we had 500 lollipops that we gave out yesterday. So, and we, of course, you know, we do the chupa chups. Is that how you pronounce it? Did I butcher that? So we give out the nice lollipops. So yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. It's really, really big in my street and my area, and people decorate their houses, and it seems like the houses with the decorations seem to be the ones that are giving out the lollies. But yeah, I also think there must be some parents groups and people saying, hey, come to my house, because they seem to know each other and know which ones to go into. And but my sister was also sharing pictures of my nephew. He was dressed as a vampire Batman, which was very creative.
Like
very and yeah, creative. It was very big in their neighborhood too. And we were actually talking about, I wish it was a thing when we were kids, because when me and my brother and my sister were little, we would attempt to go trick-or-treating and we would be told to go away by the people who lived in our street.
Yeah. Well, when I first came to Australia, it was a bit that way. I've been in Australia now 15 years. And when I first came, people were like, why are you decorating for Halloween? But our neighborhood is quite organized. There were flyers. There was a set time, all of that. There was quite a bit of coordination and people talking to each other. So
Yeah, and it's so fun. It's fun for kids and it's fun for grown-ups. And yeah, like the houses look, although I'm really scared of spiders, and I've been going on my daily walks, seeing something out of the corner of my eye and going, and then realizing, oh, it's a plastic spider, you idiot. It's a Halloween decoration. Calm down.
Well, in Australia, you know, they could be that size, right?
Yeah. Anyway, onto the podcast. We're going to talk about product commercialization, and specifically around how you take a product to market, because you are a commercialization and marketing guru. But before we get into that, there are two questions I ask every guest who comes onto the podcast. And the first one is, what are you currently watching, reading, or listening to?
Well, I used to be a really voracious reader, but I have two young girls. And unfortunately, sitting down and reading something quietly isn't something I get to do as much as I'd like. But I am currently listening to a lot of industrial design podcasts. I've just taken on a new job, and it's an industrial design and engineering company. And so this is my first time working in this space. And I found that podcasts are kind of a nice way to absorb information. So the two that I'm listening to that I really like, the first is The Rise. It's out of the States. I like hearing the accents, and also they talk about commercialization of products, which I like. And the other one is Redacted, which is actually produced here in Melbourne. But then for fun, because, you know, life is not all about work. For fun, I'm currently watching The Wheel of Time on Amazon Prime. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's really, really good. I highly recommend it. Yeah, it's based on books. And so I haven't read the book series, full transparency, but they were like published in the 90s. And then it finally came out, and it's so good. It's one of those series where my husband and I tell each other we're going to wait and watch it with each other. But then it never actually happens because we can't coordinate. So I really like that one. It's good.
Yeah, I have an fantasy Amazon series. Prime membership at the moment, but I'm kind of going through a cycle where I'm pausing some subscriptions and then looking at others. So I think I've got about a month left. So I should look at what I can smash out on Amazon before I take a little break. So I'm going to check that out, and I will include all of those in the show notes. And the other question is, what was the best career advice you ever received?
Lots of things are coming to mind, but from a professional perspective, you know, things that came into my head was like, you know, always bring a sweater, that type of thing. But from a professional perspective, I think there's two, you know, and I think they're related, so I'll share both of them. But A career coach once said to me, if you're not the smartest, most driven person in the room, then you're in the wrong room. And I think as women, this is really important. You know, the people you surround yourself, they have a really profound impact on your state of mind and your outlook. I believe that, you know, surrounding myself with ourselves, with driven, intelligent people is going to influence our point of view. And importantly, to ensure that those people are really kind and they really care about mental health. I think, you know, a lot of people don't kind of prioritize that mental health, especially women. And then the other piece of advice is, and I like the sayings, is don't set yourself on fire to keep others warm. So take care of yourself first. Don't prioritize the needs of others over your own happiness and well-being. And that might sound selfish, but as they say, you can't pour from an empty cup.
Yeah, and like on the airplane safety tutorial, you've got to put your own oxygen mask on before you can put other people's on.
Exactly.
So yeah.
Great example.
Yeah. Because if you can't breathe and you like, how are you going to be there for other people? And I think that's very true of parents as well, because you have to give so much, you know, as a career person at work, as a mom, you got to leave. Yeah, you can't have an empty tank. You know, can't drive a car on an empty tank. You got to fill it up.
I completely agree. And because I'm raising two daughters, right? I think I've always been a type A career driven person. You know, my career was always the first thing for me. And then I had children and then I had daughters. And I started thinking to myself, well, am I giving them the example? I want them to know that they can achieve anything. They can be anything. They can, you know, be the president of the United States if they want to, because they are American. But
they could also do they have dual citizenship? They could be the prime minister of Australia and the president of the United States of America.
Set yourself high, girls. But also, you know, it's all about being happy with yourself. And so that's something that I've really, as somebody who had kids a little bit later in life and all of that, I've really started to focus on that. So I think if I were, you know, giving anybody advice, it's kind of focus on the fact that you can do anything, but, you know, balance is also really critical.
You know, it's interesting what you said about having girls, because you know how you reflect on your own childhood and the examples that your own parents set for you, and you wonder, did that influence me somehow? And, you know, like my mom was always working and had a career, and she's a nurse. And so I remember when we were very young kids, like nurse, you work shift work, right? And when you're early in your nursing career, you're going to do night duty and you're going to be working like lates and earlies on weekends, and you get paid extra money for that. So, so there were a lot of times when, you know, dad was looking after us on the weekends because mom was either working or she was trying to sleep during the day. We had to be quiet, and
that didn't always
happen. Sorry, mom. but yeah, like I do think back and I think, you know, this was a long time ago that I thought that was normal. I was like, well, my mom is working, and so my dad is taking care of us. And that's normal. And, you know, here we are in 2023, and some people are still having conversations that men don't think they have to take care of their own children and they don't have to do housework. And I was like, I'm middle-aged now, you know, like I'm an elder millennial. And I was raised thinking that was completely normal because, you know, but then it's funny because sorry in advance, mom, because I know mom listens, but then mom will go, oh, you know, I wasn't there. And it's like, well, you were building a career and you're working and dad was there, or, you know, we had a grandparent or someone was looking after us. So what's the big deal? But then I also think, well, obviously that's influenced me in some way. Like, would I have had a different point of view if I'd been raised in a household with a parent, you know, a stay at home parent instead of both parents working? It's, you know, I don't know. Maybe, but we've always had a very strong work ethic in our family because our parents always worked really hard. So anyway, I went off on a big tangent there.
No, that's all right. That's all right. And what I found interesting in your story is that she was expressing some guilt, right? By you talking through this and sharing that your dad was there and that, you know, you had a bit of a role reversal. I heard when your mom saying, but I was working, that's, for me, I can hear the guilt in that because I often have that guilt too. And I think as women, as parents, as humans, we need to be just kinder to ourselves. And that's
Yeah.
what I'm, that's the journey that I'm on. I'm trying to be kinder to myself as I
Yeah.
juggle and I don't get it all right
Yeah,
yet.
and having a career, especially, you know, because I know when I was young, like you probably could afford, it was probably easier to have a stay-at-home parent, but now that's basically impossible. I mean, who can afford one person staying at home and not working at all in this economy?
Especially in Melbourne. Yeah.
Yeah. So unless you're absolutely loaded, you're going to have both parents working, but it opens up your children to, you know, a lot of other opportunities because you've got dual incomes, and you know, I think it sets a good example. Not that, you know, I'm not hating on stay-at-home parents as well. I think that's great if that's what you want to do. But yeah, I think women shouldn't feel guilty because you're probably going to raise some hardworking, independent children. And you'll be showing them, yeah, I'm working. Anyway, on to product commercialization. So I want to ask, because I feel like there is so much overlap in taking a new product to market and change management, and there's a lot that we can learn from each other. But I wanted to start at the beginning and just ask for your advice on what are some things that people should consider when they are preparing to take a new product or a revised product to market.
It's a good question, and I've been asked this question before. And I always kind of start with a clarification. A lot of people think product commercialization is like go to market and at the back end. And I think that's probably where my point of difference is. For me, product commercialization, and this is, you know, why I've worked really, really closely and been embedded in product teams in the past, is product commercialization is something that you think of upfront and throughout the development of the product. And then ultimately, yes, you have a really robust go-to-market or a marketing and sales plan, but it's not something that is thought of at the end. So I just want to clarify upfront, that's what I mean when I'm talking about product commercialization. It's a more robust, holistic point of view. And then specifically, you know, what they should consider is start with a customer. Always start with a customer. If I can give one piece of advice is, you know, if you're building something, what are the customer's needs? What are their pain points? You know, I hear this word customer centric. You know, let's be customer centric. It's a buzzword that gets thrown around a lot, but in my experience of, you know, 20 something years working with product managers, is that because they are the techie, you know, people that are building the product and creating the product, they focus on the functionality, they focus on the capabilities, how the product works, what this little widget does. And then when they engage someone like myself or, you know, a marketing colleague to develop a go-to-market plan, they haven't really fleshed out what I'd call a market scan. They haven't really looked at or identified and analyzed the needs of the market size, the competition, and not to mention the customer value proposition. And the value proposition is obviously something that marketing colleagues can help you with, but if you're not considering that up front, not after the product is, you know, created, then you're really disadvantaging yourself. So that's kind of my initial, you know, my initial thoughts on that. And you know, because I specialize in this, I've witnessed time and again what happens when people postpone the hard work of getting that ready up front until too late in the game.
Yeah, so I see so many parallels with the change management experience because one of our constant bugbears is not being included in the process early enough. And it's right at the end where people are like, oh, I think we need some content training. And somebody mentioned change. And yeah, I think if you had involved us earlier, we could have really helped you plan out, you know, what a launch or an implementation might look like. So I hear that. And I wanted to ask, have you experienced times where, yeah, you're nodding, where you've been brought in at the last minute because they, yeah, probably people think it's a go to market. And have you then felt like, you know, people are thinking of you as a blocker because you go, well, wait, but what about the value proposition? And what about this? And what about that? That's really good advice. And like, okay, I'm asking five questions in one. So this is the
That's okay.
question. Have you got case studies of, you know, where that wasn't done and things fell over?
You know, I have been approached many times by product managers seeking to help with their groundbreaking technology, the groundbreaking product. You know, it's usually a new piece of technology that fascinates them that they've created. And then I start to ask, okay, great, you know, happy to help you. tell me about your customer research. What market analysis have you done? Who's going to use this? And the typical response is, oh, we haven't done the research yet, but we know this is going to work in this space because we work in this space because we know this technology and it's going to fill a gap in market, right? Like they're so sure of it because they are, they're on the, you know, the ground floor and they're immersed in it and they're looking at it, you know, only that. But what they haven't done is kind of lifted their head up and looked outside of their product or their project. So that's, you know, that's kind of a limitation of that function. And there's people that can help them. They don't have to do it themselves. They don't have to do the market scan themselves, but they need to be leveraging people like yourself or myself who can help them to facilitate that. I will share one little anecdote. I won't name names, but
no.
I once got brought into work on a product that was failing. Like they were like, this product's failing in market beck. Can you do your magic? I think is like the brief
it's
I got.
It's so much harder to fix something that's already
let me just snap my fingers.
In market
anyway.
And tanking than just do it right the first time. Yeah. Anyway, continue.
So their current sales strategy had been in place for years, like 3-4 years. This product had been out in market. It's a B2B product, large corporate, and they'd been targeting the big end of town, the tier one customers, which we, all the B2B people out there know that those are really difficult sales engagements, longer lead times, et cetera, longer sales cycles. And so after I did my market analysis, right, it was clear that the service wasn't actually consumable by those type of customers. Yeah. The technology integration, literally how the product had been built, wouldn't integrate easily with large corporate, you know, clients. And so they had been going after a subset of clients, a subset of customers that literally would have difficulty integrating with the service. And so what I identified was mid-sized customers were actually better. So, you know, we put that in place and we started to get some wins, but sadly, because the product had been unprofitable and, it hadn't been kind of bringing in a return on investment, the corporation decided to just exit the product because, you know, it wasn't bringing enough money. And I think that's really sad. And that's probably the most, the most impactful example that comes to mind when I think of the value that product commercialization, change managers, et cetera, could have on a product, because there's a product that completely got exited from market purely because the upfront sales strategy wasn't aligned with the actual use in market. So that's just one anecdote.
And it, it seems like there was a real lack of understanding of who the customers are.
Yes.
And like you said, sit customer value proposition. So, which is the first question is, who are the customers?
Yeah. Who is the customer?
And was it a good product? Like, did you think it was a really good product that had potential?
I think it solved a pain point in market. Was it the most competitive product? You know, potentially not, but it was solving a pain point and it was aligned with the values of the organization. So it just, you know, it just wasn't set up for success. And unfortunately, I get brought into a lot of situations like that where, you know, Beck, this isn't working. We've tried this, but it's still not working. Fix it. Right. And it is a lot harder to come in after the fact.
Oh yeah. I've worked on it. I call those recovery. You know, some of my colleagues call them
like CPR,
and bucket in aisle four. But yeah, like we don't have Jedi mind powers. Like if I did, I probably would be in the Mediterranean somewhere, you know, right now.
I wouldn't be doing this. As much as I love my job.
I know, but yeah, we can't wave a magic wand and make people love this product or love this change. You know, you've got to do a lot of work up front to be ready for that. And yeah, like when you're brought in and it is disappointing that sometimes the people who can help only get brought in when things go wrong, because it is so much easier to be involved from the start, help with the planning, like help, you know, whether it's the product owner or if we're thinking project land for the project manager and sponsors through that journey and then implement it well, it's going to have a much better chance of going well than if you're brought in. But yeah, it happens all the time, all the time.
And I think it's also, you know, I know you and I both worked for large corporates and people in change roles or product commercialization roles or even go to market roles, they're not as plentiful. There's a lot of product managers, a lot of other resources. And unfortunately, there's usually a handful of people. And so in defense of product managers, you know, it's also sometimes difficult for them to get the resources. Even if they would like to engage us up front, sometimes there's only, you know, four or five of us in the whole organization. And that's also a bit of a shame from my point of view as well. I understand, you know, there's budget considerations and all of that, but it's difficult when you only have, you know, three or four people in an organization, you know, they have hundreds of products when you, which is what a lot of large corporates have. So,
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of large corporations also have a handful of change people who are too busy and they don't get given the budget to have that person. It's a real problem that, you know, organizations are just ruled by cost and you have a small group of people who control the money and their whole MO is keeping costs down. Like I actually, if I may share a story myself, I was recently at a agility conference in Lisbon and they had this guy called Joe Justice and he was talking about his experience working for Tesla. And he basically said, you know, anyone can go and buy a piece of machinery. Like you don't need to have some procurement person or have a senior executive sign off. Like if you think this is what's right for the business, like you can do it. There are some internal like peer reviews that you need to go through. So your peers will need to agree. Yes, this $1 million piece of machinery absolutely is going to do this, this, and this. And he said, you know, Tesla's goal isn't to make money. It's other goals. And I went, yeah, it's owned by an eccentric billionaire who's not answering to shareholders and the stock market. And I mean, you know, he's probably answering to a board, but yeah, I just went, wow, like it blew my mind that something like that exists, you know, regardless of what your thoughts are on Elon Musk as a person and, you know, his leadership style. I just like I was like, you've just described this like agile utopia. But for the rest of us, like we're living in a world where you're never allowed to spend any money. And it's people like us who when you're not allowed to spend the money on like change management, product commercialization, go to market, marketing. We're always the ones that people are saying no to.
We are. And when we do, I don't know about you, but when I get brought into a project or, you know, product development process, especially when it's from a top-down point of view, because I'll say, okay, why are we doing this? And they're like, we need to make more money or we need to, you know, recover costs or it's an efficiency. And then I say, well, okay, what about the customer? What about the market? What about our competitors? You know, and they're like, we just need to make
more questions.
We just need to make more money or we need to, you know, create efficiencies. And I do understand, you know, from a business perspective, we need to make money and we need to create efficiencies, but it often there's then becomes a friction point between the ultimate success, because if it's a top-down cost recovery or just a revenue play, but you don't have those market drivers, you don't understand what customers actually want, then your chance to have a successful product or, you know, revamp of a product, an existing product, are going to be decreased because there's not that market customer fit. So it does feel a little bit like a square peg round hole sometimes, but many, many times I got brought in, why are we launching this product? We think, you know, we think we can squeeze a lot of money out of it. Do customers actually want it? We'll figure that out through the go-to-market process, right? And so it's sort of chicken egg for me, and it can be a little bit frustrating if I'm honest.
Yeah, I have a lot of approaches from potential clients, and they say, "Oh, we need some change management training." Well, that's usually what, and I go, "Okay, what? Tell me about the problem that you're trying to solve." And they describe a problem, and I go, "I can take your money and deliver some training."
Yeah.
That's actually not going to solve that problem. That's a band-aid. And then what's going to happen is you're going to feel like, you know, you may not want my services again because it didn't solve the problem. So I'm going to suggest that, you know, and often the problem is, you know, something that's a lot more difficult. It's like it's a cultural issue or, you know, there's some performance issue. There's many things that we get to the bottom of. And I'm like, yeah, putting people in a two-hour training session with a consultant is not going to solve that problem. Change managing it is not going to, and that's the other thing. If a product is bad or a change is a bad idea, a change manager can't help you. Like, have you heard that? You've been living in Australia for a while. Have you heard the phrase, you can polish a turd, but you can't make it shine? Like, I can, you know.
Yes,
like,
I have.
I'm not in the business of turd polishing, right?
Put that on your business cards. Yeah.
I will make it shine. No. But I'm sure marketers and, you know, like product commercialization people aren't either. Like, you have to make sure that this is something that people really need. And look, if you are happy to just throw to market instead of go to market and then find out how things go, like, great, great. But most companies are not in the position to do that because they have all of these ROI and cost pressures, right?
Yeah. And I guess, and I have, most of my career has been large corporates, but I have worked with smaller, you know, companies on the side. And what I will say is, you know, large corporates have that luxury of potentially failing or not going as well. But when it's a smaller company, then this becomes even more critical because you kind of only get one chance, right?
Still die. And you could go bankrupt if you mess up a product launch. Lose funding. So are there any other common traps that people fall into when they're trying to bring a product to market?
Yeah, I mean, we've touched on this quite a bit, but you know, just to reiterate, bringing a new product to market, it's fraught with unknowns and risks. So I'm not saying that if you think of these things up front, it's going to be smooth sailing. It's just that you'll be better prepared and you'll have plans in place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from a marketing perspective, when you're launching a new product, the demand usually has to be created during that product's initial market development stage. Yep. How long that takes depends on the product's complexity, its newness, customer, et cetera, et cetera. But doing that market customer analysis up front really helps with that. But as part of that, I just want to drill into one aspect. It's the making sure the price and the value are aligned. The number of times I've come in and I've said, well, what are you going to charge for this? Or what is the price point? Or how does it sit? And yes, they've done analysis, but they haven't tested it. They haven't done the customer research. They haven't done the customer side of that, right? They've done the financial side. They'll bring out Excel spreadsheets and show me. And that obviously is critical. I'm not saying you shouldn't do those modelings, but then, you know, testing that in market. So, you know, and then the other side of that is, what does good look like? So if anybody's ever had a meeting with me, undoubtedly, I've asked that question. Okay, what does good look like? What does good look like for this product, for this project, whatever they're trying to achieve? And, you know, why I'm mentioning that from the price and value alignment is because obviously we work in commercial settings. We have to make sure that we're bringing in the money. And I always find it really interesting when I say, okay, well, what does good look like? They don't usually have this thought through. They might have one big number, but I'm like, okay, well, how does that apply, you know, by quarter? When, how long do you have to bring that back? So it does take quite a bit of discussion when I'm brought in to kind of work through what are the goals, what is the commercial objectives, and then, you know, then going through that process at the point where you've engaged a marketer, you can imagine that just slows everything down because a good sales and marketing plan should ladder up to what does good look like. So that's one trap. And then the last one, which I think you as a change manager can really relate to, is setting realistic timelines. So I know that sounds simple. I know that sounds basic, but you know, I have been brought in and then timelines change and change and change and change and change. And I understand that things have to be agile. I know that, you know, how products are developed these days is more agile. And I also am conscious, I just said, bring me in at the beginning, but the communication of the timeline, if things change, and this is where, you know, from my point of view, I've gotten a lot of value from change managers, is the communication of those changes really helps because, you know, creating the accountability to adhere to a timeline, it helps reduce costs. It allows the marketing team or sales team to build out their campaign in the most robust way. So I know it sounds basic, but the timeline or the communication of the timeline is really helpful from a product development perspective.
Yeah. And I think like that initial planning piece to make sure the timeline is actually realistic, therefore you can communicate it confidently, because one trap that I see a lot as a change manager is people pull out, you know, they go, oh, we've got to do blah, blah change. And they just pull some arbitrary date out of their ass, basically, that is not related in any way to how much work needs to be done to make. It's usually related to an executive's KPI or, you know, and another one is the license is running out and it's going to cost the company a lot more money. So let's get it done before that happens so we don't have to pay. And then they communicate it, but they haven't actually done the planning. And so then, you know, almost immediately it becomes behind. And then the next comms is, oh, it's three. And, you know, people lose trust and faith in their leaders when that happens. And but then the converse is, look, things happen and things change and that's okay. But I think if you do that planning piece, like what you said, you can go, you can be reasonably confident that, okay, these are all the things we need to do to get this product to market. This is how long we think it takes. And yes, if we have something that disrupts that, let's be honest about it.
Yeah.
And transparent, because those, let's be real, like we both work in, like those things do happen a lot. I think I maybe I can count the amount of projects that went live on time and within budget on one hand. Of infinity projects.
Or less.
But most of the time, okay, it was because they were unrealistic at the, you know, because often I'll start and people will be like, oh, we're going live on this day. And I'm like, I'm not going to stress about it because that's not going to happen. And so I'm not going to freak out.
I've had the same, the number of times I get briefed, and this is the benefit that you and I have because we've been working in this space for so long, you know, 20 something years of working in this space. You kind of look at the timeline and you're like, yeah, there's no chance, because you know how to read the overall project and plan. But I think to myself, you know, people who are more junior, the younger marketing crew that gets briefed and then they don't understand that they're not quite there. It just wastes a lot of time and can create frustration. And then what you really want is marketers and product people to work hand in glove. And so if you constantly kind of aren't aligned on timelines and you seem to be wasting marketers' times and things like that, it just creates friction. So, you know, my advice is just to be realistic, but to do it up front.
And I think, so I know you have a master's in change management as well as, your extensive marketing and product commercialization experience. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think marketing folk and product owners can learn from change managers? And I know you've touched on it a bit, and how can us change practitioners help those people bring a product to life?
Obviously, I'm a strong believer in formal change management practices. You know, I think it's also why you and I have always worked really well together. You know, people often ask me, why did you get a master's degree in change? And I think my driving force was, it can be done better, right? Like things can be done better. And I saw change as a facilitator of that, of improvement. So while I have never been formally employed as a change manager, and I get a lot of questions about that, you got a master's degree, but you didn't go into change, I don't think it's a coincidence that I've specialized in product commercialization and also have a master's degree in change management. I think those two things are very linked. I think that, you know, having an understanding of change is really helpful to helping a product team manage their product life cycle. So, you know, to answer your question, I think what marketers and product owners can learn from change managers is how to systematically approach change. And you don't need to have a degree in it. You don't need to, but to have an appreciation and to value it is really critical. The rigor that change managers set in goal setting, in communications, in process documentation as part of a formal change management plan is not something I've seen organically from other business functions. People try, project managers try, but there's a different approach that change managers take that's just not something that happens without conscious planning from other organization, other functions within an organization. So, you know, in particular, where I've seen change managers play a really robust role, just to give an anecdote of kind of where I've seen it work really well, is software development, digital product space. Most of my career, I have worked with digital products, and product owners in that space want to ensure the upgrades actually improve their products. It's very an agile working way of working. They don't want to accidentally, inadvertently create problems for the developers and users. So because they are working so agile and because they are often releasing things in an iterative way, a robust change management strategy helps to achieve the balance and keeps the software development process running smoothly while getting incremental improvements out to market. Where I've seen change managers add a lot of value is in this space. They always run a more robust process when the change manager's involved. So that's one example, that software digital product development space. I've really seen change managers add a lot of value by working alongside with the product teams on that. Similar to how a product commercialization, but I'm looking at it from a different lens. I think having a change manager embedded into that space is really, really helpful. And I'll give you one other example if you want it. I mentioned earlier the product life cycle. So supporting the different stages of a product life cycle. So obviously, large corporates, have products that go through, that life cycle of being launched in a market, and then they mature, and then they eventually start to decline. And the company, the product managers are going to enact strategies, and they're going to try to make changes based on how the market is receiving that good service, et cetera. And what they're trying to do is obviously squeeze as much juice out of that lemon as they can possibly get to best manage the product's performance. I have seen change managers, and I feel change managers add a lot of value to this process. I'm obviously telling you something that you already know. I know that you believe this as well,
Keep
but
telling me though.
just to
We love to hear
I
it.
know, I know. I'm like, just to give my endorsement of it is change managers in that space. What I've seen is add a lot of value when communicating the risks to stakeholders. So often, the product manager may have raised it and things like that, but when it's built into a formal change communication plan, it often gets more of the gravitas, the structure, and is usually represented in governance meetings and things like that. So I find that really valuable, communicating risks and also getting the buy-in from stakeholders through the product development process. So obviously in large matrix organizations, which is where you and I have, worked and met each other, adding that value and adding that level of governance has been really, really helpful. And I've seen that work really well throughout my career.
Amazing. I actually thought of an example as well while you were talking, and one is around staff capability and adoption, particularly when you're in a retail setting, where you may have stores or you may have people calling a call center where there's a bazillion products in that store or shop. And if you're not actually equipping the people who work in that setting with the information they need to better sell the product, or even better, incentivizing them to sell the product, then how is your product going to sell itself? Because I see that a lot. And I've seen a lot of examples where, somebody wants to try out some new products or new ways of working or new ways of selling things, but they don't actually have the balls to amend the KPI structure and the incentive structure for those staff. So I've seen where staff on the shop floor are still incentivized to do things the old way. And it's like, well, why would they do what you're telling them to do? Because that's actually going to cost them money. Or, it's going to cost their mates money because the current process might be, well, they're going to refer this customer to someone else. I'm thinking specifically of bank branches now in the branch, and that person's going to get the sale. And you're asking them to do something different so that no one in the branch gets that win of that cut. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So I see that a lot is how are you going to enable and incentivize your staff to sell the crap out of this thing? Like, I remember, this was one of my first jobs. I used to work in a surf shop in my school holidays because I also had a job at McDonald's. But in holidays, I'd make more money by going and working in this surf shop. And I remember the very first Christmas I was there,
You
Mambo,
surf? Sorry to
me.
interrupt you. Do you surf?
Well, it's
No.
funny because I'm from a small town in South Australia that was nowhere near the beach, but it was the
Okay. They had a
90s
surf
when
shop.
surf culture was massive in the 90s in Australia. Like, all of the, there's actually a documentary about it. I'll put it in the show notes. I think Girls Can't, it's all about the rise of female surfing culture and, all of that stuff. It's a whole thing. But yeah, no, I worked in a surf shop in the like furthest flung outer suburb of Adelaide. And Mambo had a promotion on that if you sell this many watches, you get a free watch and, a chunk of money. So guess who was selling Mambo watches that Christmas, suggesting Mambo watches as a present? you know, yeah. over the Rip Curl watch or whatever other mm-hmm. watch. And it's like, yeah, that was, there was a very clear incentive. And we all took the time to learn about the watches because we wanted to get a free watch and we wanted the sales bonus. Very simple stuff, but so many organizations, and it probably comes back to what you said about, you know, that upward management, like, are your sponsors sponsoring this? Because they're the ones, like, it's not that, I don't think that's the product owner or the marketer's responsibility, but whoever is sponsoring, AKA providing the funds, that's probably an executive that probably sits with them to go, well, what are they going to do to remove those roadblocks? The sales and incentivize staff, and you know, if they have need to speak to people in other areas.
Exactly. So that's... Yeah. Well, and usually how that goes, because I have worked in retail incentives, and we would put forward a plan, right? And we would say we want to do this, but often those retail shops are being pulled in 1,000 directions, you know, so who makes the call, right? So who makes the call of what they're going to focus on when? And so, yes, bubbling that up to management, bubbling that up so that people can say, well, the reason we need this incentive or we need this focus during this time to support this objective, again, that means that we have to have really clear objectives, really clear, goals in mind. But if we can clearly communicate that up to management with the help of change, that's really critical, because it kind of cuts through the red tape, especially in large corporates, cutting through and not having to navigate one-on-one and broker deals and all the things that you do in a large corporate is really helpful. So yeah, I can see change managers adding a lot of value there too.
Yeah. And I know banking used to be really good at clarity for their frontline and protecting their frontline, but I've worked in other retail environments where it was just a free for all, and they were getting emails from, you know, all these different parts of the business telling them to do all these different things. And one, people on the shop floor don't check their emails because they're out on the shop floor, like working, actually doing the core business stuff that keeps the business afloat. Yep. And so they don't know what to listen to. So then they just focus whatever's related to their KPIs. Right. So that's what I found.
As they should, because that structure should, you know, be supporting them. But again, you know, if that structure isn't robust and aligned to the business strategy, to the product strategy, then that's where we get strife. And yes, I think product commercialization, go to market, change managers working collaboratively together can help face into things like that. Yeah.
Amazing. This has been a wonderful and very insightful chat. Do you have anything else, any other advice you'd like to give the listeners before we wrap up?
I think I've covered, I feel like I've been chatting at you. I think I've covered most things. This, like I said, this is my first podcast. So, you know, thank you for making it easy. Thank you for making it fun. Thank you for making it a topic that I could talk about all day. I could just talk, we could just sit here and have a cocktail and keep chatting.
Right.
I think, you know, put customer first and foremost, back yourself, and, you know, have some tenacity in your approach. That's kind of what I give when I'm managing a team. It's sort of, make sure that you are advocating for the customer, because my experience is not a lot of other people are. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really good advice. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on Casa de Cambio, and I hope your first podcast experience was a good one. And for the listeners, we're going to be back soon with more episodes. And remember, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, write a review. Otherwise, see you soon. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you.